When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Sons of a Gun, a podcast about the DC Universe. I'm Alex Gunn.
I'm Justin Gunn.
And we are sons of a celebrity parent we can't talk about here, who also has absolutely nothing, to be clear, with the to do with the thing that we're about to talk about, which is Joker Folie à Deux, now in theaters. We're going to be talking about the movie. We're going to be talking about spoilers throughout. So if you haven't seen it in theaters, like most people in the world, maybe turn away until you do get to see it or see it on streaming. We'll also be talking about the disastrous box office this week. And we're taping this on Sunday morning before they put out the final box office results. But it does look like this is way lower than expected, not to weigh down box office talk too much here at the top, because I do want to get into qualitatively first before we get into spoilers. Obviously, first movie came out big, almost $100 million opening weekend, made over $1 billion at the box office.
Huge success. Oscar wins.
Exactly. Huge success. Very much a flashpoint in culture as well because of the content of the movie. Justin, I'm curious to hear from you. What were your thoughts on the first one? What were your thoughts on the first one before we even get into Joker Folie à Deux? Just so people have a sense of how we're feeling going into this new movie.
The first one, I thought I liked the performances. I do think Joaquin is very good in this role, and clearly I think he likes doing it. There's something that has drawn him to this particular take on Joker, and he feels like he likes it. And the first one, you sort of get introduced to that. I think the story was so bleak, and I think it was hard to sort of get adjusted into the movie where you're following it's a protagonist who you like can't who is like falling apart, has a horrible life, and it only gets worse until he sort of finds fame by murdering people and lashes out against a society that crushes him down. That's a hard thing to be like, perfect, no notes. And I should also say that my wife, who doesn't watch comic book stuff, never really been involved, despite the fact that takes up 90% of my mental life, she loved the Joker. Like, to a shocking where I was starting to be like, uh-oh, what does this mean?
Oh, did she get twisted?
She's a little twisted. Okay. She's a little twisted.
Right. That's pretty cool. I didn't like the movie at all. In fact, I'll fully cop to the fact that when I saw it in theaters, I fell asleep midway through, which never happens to me when I'm watching a movie. I found it boring and trite, to be perfectly honest. I agree with you. I like Joaquin Phoenix as a performer, and he puts everything into a role when he does something. So that is certainly laudable, but I found it extraordinarily derivative. My fear going in, like a lot of people, was this is going to be some take up arms, man boys, and shoot up the theater type thing, like when we got the Dark Knight shooting back in the day, which was harrowing and awful. So I was very worried about that. But once I actually saw the movie, it's pretty much a retread of Taxi Driver meets King of Comedy. It is extremely derivative of Scorsese's work. I don't think it had an original thing to say at all. It was well filmed, but it was well filmed because it was Todd Phillips, the writer-director, aping Scorsese and trying to do that rather than doing anything new. So that was my thought on it, was I was really just not impressed by the movie necessarily at all. I don't think it brought anything new to the table, and I was annoyed, but just sort of in the way that like buzzing flies annoyed by people being like, yes, this is really saying something about society. And to me, it felt like the level of somebody being like, you know, society, huh? Have you thought about that? And that's pretty much it. So that was my feeling on the first movie.
Well, and I think that's fair. I do think the reactions to that movie were so extreme in either direction to the point where the movie won Oscars. Like people like backed it so hard and felt like it was doing the opposite of what you're saying, was really like this dark. And I think that is on the back of Joaquin's performance that got it there, as opposed to it being like, wow, what a great reflection. There's so much to think about. Like, can you imagine going back on a casual Sunday, being like, oh, I got a couple hours, let me throw on the first Joker? Yikes.
Well, it's also, and I don't know, I think too much about the box office. Certainly that's top of mind because that's what everybody is talking about as we're taping this. But 2019 was a very unique time. It was a flash in the pan that I don't think we're ever going to recapture for comic book movies, or at least not in the next couple of decades, where if you look at like late 2018, the first Aquaman came out, made over $1 billion. 2019, insane. Captain Marvel came out. And mind you, that was right after Infinity War, when everybody was hyped to the gills. And that came directly after that, made over $1 billion. Joker came out in 2019, made over $1 billion. We've seen very clearly with the second Aquaman, and granted that did better internationally, but that did an infinitesimal amount of what that first movie made.
There's been some slipping.
Yes, Captain Marvel to the Marvels, exactly the same thing, plummeted. And now we're seeing the same thing with Joker, where I think that was, looking back, probably a large part of Joker, because they were like, you see these MCU movies that are doing so well? We're the twisted take that your mom doesn't want you to see.
Yeah, and edgier.
Exactly. And it wasn't actually edgy, but that's how it felt in comparison to everything
else. Well, and I would say it was different. And I mean, this is maybe giving it too much compliment. It was edgier than those movies. And I do think for better or worse, and though it is sort of derivative, I do think the visual style of these movies is at least interesting. There are some great shots in the first one. There are some great shots in the movie we're about to talk about. Like there's some visual work here that I think is at least not nice to see.
Yeah, I 100% will not disagree with that. And I'll also throw out there for anybody listening to this who is a Joker super fan, go crazy. Have a great time. I'm never upset about anybody liking anything. I had my feelings about it, but you know, obviously a lot of people like this and went to see it. Let's jump in then and talk about Joker, Folie en Deux. So,
well, before we get to the actual movie, I want to say Joker's such a huge hit, and then it's like, okay, sequel coming. And then when it was announced, it was Harley, it was Lady Gaga, it was a musical. I was like, oh, okay, this could be a real like flight of fancy. It could be just like a real cracked rom-com kind of a thing that was like took some of the more like see attitude of the first one and turned it into, spun it up into something that is more sort of creative and from a internal Joker POV. He slipped all the way into the full character, and we get this true romance Bonnie and Clyde type thing.
Yeah,
so that was my expectation, and the trailer I think backed that up.
Yeah, no, and I'm totally agreeing with you. I think when we did our movie preview, I think this was in the Comic Book Club feed, I said this was my most anticipated movie because exactly the point that you're making, like there was a chance, a shot here to really do something absolutely wild and absolutely different in a way that maybe was kind of a screw you to the first movie, you know, sort of like a Gremlins 2 to a Gremlins, if you know what I mean.
Wow. A very common comparison you're making. That's how you refer to your kids, right? You're like, and then our second child, sort of our Gremlins 2.
Right. Sort of like a screw you to the first child. Oh, God, I hope my kids don't listen to this.
What are the odds?
Not very good, to be honest. The thing that happened, though, is I got pretty hyped about it because of everything that they were doing around the movie. And then Todd Phillips started talking, and Todd Phillips started giving interviews, and all of his interviews were like, this isn't a musical. It's just when they don't know what else to do, they sing songs. And literally everybody was like, that is the definition of a musical. That is the purpose of a musical.
Yeah, that's literally what it is.
Stop pretending like we're reinventing a musical. And Lady Gaga, mind you, this is not, she does this with every movie. She gives these amazing quotes where she's basically saying how she invented acting. And she talks about, like, you know, what I did was I really got in the headspace of Harleen Quinzel, and then I crafted a character around that. And you're like, yes, what are you? And it's great. God bless her. God bless her.
Yeah,
she's
no,
really,
it's nice.
She's really discovering this new thing.
That's such a very modern way of communicating. That's how everyone famous communicates. Is like, I did this thing that many have done before, but you wouldn't believe how I did it. Mm-hmm. I opened my mouth and it wasn't words that came out, but it was words, but there was other noise in between the words. They're calling it a song. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
My favorite recent one, and this is very far afield, we can get back, but Chris Evans talking about his ending monologue in Deadpool and Wolverine, and he's like, yeah, I memorized all the words, and people are like, wow, that's so cool. And I'm like, that's your job!
That's so funny.
What are you talking about?
Wow. He's like, a lot of actors only memorize like syllables and letters. I did the whole words. It's like, anyway, I bet you earned your lunch.
Yeah, at a certain point, I think we just need to stop talking to actors, you know, like we've got to, or just ask a minimum amount of questions of them. They get 5 questions total for any movie because these press tours are wearing them out and they're just saying insane things.
Well, I also think this is a very modern thing where every fan, every reporter is a fan, and the tone is so like amazing. When it used to be like more of a profile, and you could be like, oh yeah, but that's just your job, right? And like, it's sort of a little bit squared off. And now it's such a like boosting everything up. And so it makes for these interviews where you're like, you're treating these people like they're on training wheels. Like, give them, they're very famous, well-paid, doing a job that we just want to hear about.
Yes. Anyway, that is far afield from what we're talking about with the movie here, but I think that gives us a good sense of background going into this, how we felt going to the movie. I will say I saw this Thursday evening in one of the preview showings here in Brooklyn. It was basically empty. There were a couple of people in there. Yeah, basically empty. And the only people who were in there, there was one couple who was talking very loudly the entire time. There's another guy who was on his phone, and I thought he was pointing it at the screen to record it, but nope, he was in a bunch of chat rooms on his phone the entire time, like literally the entire movie. And I wanted to lean over and be like, could you please turn off your phone? But also, I don't know.
What are they saying? what are the chat rooms saying?
Yeah, but it's fine. I don't understand why people go to a movie theater, pay money, and then be like, I'm going to ignore this movie the entire time. There's better ways.
Well, you just want to say you watched it. I saw it Saturday night, Alamo Drafthouse in Brooklyn. I showed up right before the cutoff where they don't seat you. You know, where they're like, if you're 15 minutes late, they like don't allow you. And I was like literally running to the door, and they're like, you can go in. I was like, thank God. Sat down. Packed, every seat full, right in front of me. I was in the second row. Right in front of me were 2, I want to say, like 10-year-olds. I was whoo, with their parents or with their some caregiver. I was like, holy shit, what a bad idea. But yeah.
Well, interesting. I'm very curious to hear about your experience then, given you actually saw it with a whole audience with probably good audio, because that's the other thing I should mention is like they had the not even AC. It was like a fan full blast the entire time, which not great for a musical when you're trying to hear the soundtrack and everything. But so that might have affected my viewing a little bit. What was your take? What was your overall take on the movie? And what was the feeling from the audience as well? I'm curious.
Well, yeah, I'll say audience first. Very little reaction from anyone. There was occasionally from like just you could hear it just popping off a little bit around. So I think similarly to what we're saying, I think a lot of people were probably excited to see this Saturday night, prime time, prime movie viewing time, like 9:40 on a Saturday night. And then for me, I was like, woof, this movie is mad. This movie is like, I feel like Todd Phillips or whatever, or the script, not the performers, because I think they were doing their work. But this movie is sort of like, yeah, what you like is dumb. And it's sort of like being snarky about comic book movies, the Joker character, the success of the first one, the idea that you think this would be better than the first one, and sort of putting a thumb in our eye, I think. And, you know, there's a lot of small examples of that. But the story, I thought, was just unendingly bleak, but also empty. It didn't have – I was like, you want us to think these people are in love? You've given us nothing. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, you're like, you don't want them to be – they're not in love? Yeah. I don't know. It left me feeling like – like, you know, on a cold day and you hear someone like hit a metal pipe and it's like, that noise is so hurtful. That's what this movie felt like.
So I will say, despite everything that I said in the first 15 or so minutes of this podcast, I still want to like something when I'm sitting down, when I'm spending my time. And I actually thought the beginning of the movie, there was promise there. I didn't love everything that was going on, but I thought there were some interesting swings. It felt like there was a potential narrative flow that they were going to follow. And not to call out a specific point, because I'm sure we're going to talk about specific points in a second, but it felt like it was the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest arc of like, we're in this place, we're trapped here. And I thought the idea was like, oh, how can love and hope flourish in a dark place like Arkham? And leading up to the escape of Joker and Harley, I was like, okay. And then they run through the town and we're going to, you know, see what that's like, and it's going to fall apart somehow. That's interesting to me. Like, that is the flow of a musical. That is interesting. And then as soon as they try to escape and don't, the movie went way downhill from there, became hideously unfocused, didn't, I think, know what it was trying to say or how it was trying to say it. And even the things, the ideas that potentially were interesting that it threw out in that second, I don't know, third half, two thirds, whatever it was of the movie, where it started to go into the trial. And I saw somebody online compare, or several people online compare it to like the final episode of Seinfeld, where it was just deconstructing the first movie. And that was pretty much it. There were some interesting ideas there in terms of being a referendum on the first movie and the discussion around the first movie, but it wasn't clear that's what the movie wanted to say or what it was trying to do or what conclusion it was getting to. And I don't need it stated out loud, but I've seen a lot of like, because the movie is tagging, people who were fans of the first one are reclaiming this movie already. And they're like, no, you just don't get it. It's secretly genius. And I don't think it is. I think it went in a million different directions and just didn't choose one.
Well, in that way, it does feel like a heightened version of the sort of bleaker parts of the first one, where like they taking all of that sort of life is hard and then it gets worse and there's nothing for you. It takes that and sort of then gets after the people that were elevating Joker. And because in the movie, in the first one, he gets famous for being like, for, you know, externalizing his internal pain and trauma and all that.
Yeah. And for killing Robert De Niro on live television.
Yeah, exactly. And in this movie, it picks up on that right at sort of 2 years later, but sort of right off of that. And then it undercuts even that. It undercuts that power. And I sort of like the idea of that, of when he finally comes clean in the courtroom and says like, no, I'm just this. This is just who I am. I was like, oh, that's an interesting idea and sort of a cool way to undercut how we elevate like villainy in our movies for sure. And then in our real world, we elevate just extremity as, no matter what the moral compass is. Mm-hmm. That's a cool idea, but it was so bleak and we were so like messed up at that point in the movie, both from confusion and also just like seeing everyone get crushed. That even Joker, when he puts on the makeup in the courtroom, you're like, oh, it's gonna, this is like the fun part. And they're like, no, that's not fun here. It's the saddest part.
I think that points to the inherent problem of the movie. And granted, I meant to go back and revisit Joker before I saw this just to sort of have a sense of it because it's been 5 years or whatever. But Arthur Fleck, the character that Joaquin Phoenix playing, is not interesting at all. Like, he is a completely empty void of a human being. And I think that's what it's supposed to be. That sometimes works in terms of like when Heath Ledger does the Joker in The Dark Knight, where it's just, you don't know anything about him. And that's something that they play up as kind of scary, is he could be anything at any moment. Arthur Fleck, that I thought wincingly knock knock joke that he does at the end where he's like, knock, knock, who's there? Arthur Fleck. Arthur Fleck who?
Yeah.
I was like, ah, okay, I get what you're going for here, but this is very embarrassing for everybody concerned.
When they cut on that, I was like, Jesus, dude. That's when the person next to me went, poof.
Yes. That to me, though, gets to the sense of like the two problems with the movie. One, that Arthur Fleck is nothing. He's just not an interesting guy. And for all of these people to be rallying around him, there's something to be said about a guy who steps up in this identity of the Joker and inspires all of these people, but really secretly he has imposter syndrome or whatever is going on here. But I don't think the movie wants to go all the way on that. Actually, I've forgotten what the other part is. I'm sure I'll come back. Oh, and then I think the movie just in general is like embarrassed of any of the directions it's going in. Like, very clearly with the musical aspect where it's trying to be like, no, exactly what Todd Phillips said. He's like, no, we're not a musical. We just have people singing sometimes. And like, that comes through in Lady Gaga, who purposefully has to sing badly throughout the movie to be like, I am a normal person versus Lady Gaga. And that's not the point of a musical. The point of a musical is these people have no choice to sing, but to sing. And it comes out. And instead of having Joaquin Phoenix singing awfully and Lady Gaga, with one exception, singing like off key and scratchy so that she seems normal, that's not fun or interesting to watch in any way. Like, pushing it all the way would have been interesting, but instead it doesn't want to be a musical. It doesn't want to be a comedy. It doesn't want to be a romance. It doesn't want to go all the way in throwing Joker under the bus, maybe because it's like, we still got to court those fans of the first movie. It's too embarrassed to go fully in any particular direction.
Well, and I don't know if it's Todd Phillips to blame for that, but he did write and direct this because it definitely does feel that way. Like, it's like the kid who in high school in a classic like 80s plotline who like was a dork and then he gets cool and then he shits on his old friends now that he's cool. And you could feel that in the movie, like you're saying, because it starts with this animated cartoon thing. That I was like, that's cool, that's weird. And it feels like it's purposely saying like, here's this, we're in this like not real perspective. This is someone who can't take reality, so we're getting a cartoon vision of the world. I was like, perfect. That tracks so well with musical, where it's you heighten out of reality with songs because you can't express the emotion in normal speech to the people. And I'm like, perfect, you're trapped in Arkham Asylum. Of course you're going to have flights of fancy into musical. You have a romance that is happening in your brain. And they do that a little bit. But they don't. They're too scared or afraid or embarrassed, like you're saying, to commit to that. So then that becomes like sort of a half-done romance. And then the movie goes way out of its way to undercut everything, to undercut the rest of this movie, the entire first Joker. And then I think eventually, comic book movies in general, the audience that likes comic book movies and any comic book movie in the Batman franchise that comes out of this, I think it's all saying like, this is all dumb. This is dumb.
Well, it's saying that. And then in the last couple of minutes, and without jumping too far ahead, but maybe we could talk about this now. In the last couple of minutes, it's like, we're embarrassed of being a comic book movie. We're not your grandma's comic book movie. Oh, by the way, Harvey Dent's here. There's an explosion. He gets half of his face a little scarred. You guys like that, right? He has like a kind of a two-face thing going on, but not exactly, not completely. It's just like a little bit. And then, well, yes, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm going to continue what you're saying, I think. Like, I feel like it's saying, like, yeah, and we got to do this stuff for you guys. Like, look, he got a little blood on his face. And then I think the low-hanging fruit version of it is when the dude stabs him. And mm-hmm. I think we're meant to think that that's the Heath Ledger Joker.
Yeah, I mean, that whole scene at the end is Arthur Fleck gets stabbed in the hallway. I am so conflicted. We could probably talk about the guards at Arkham at some point, because, like, I know Arkham Asylum is supposed to be the worst place. This is Arkham State Prison or whatever they're calling it. But the level the guards are like, yeah, go wherever, do whatever you want. No big deal, is crazy in this movie.
Doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense at all. And particularly that last scene, unless they prearranged it, the guard's like, okay, leaving you behind, Arthur. Bye-bye. Have fun in this hallway with the psychopath. So, yeah, this psychopath played by, what is it? It's not Colin Story. I don't remember his first name. Corin Story, something like that. Anyway, this actor who plays unnamed inmate shows up, tells him a joke, quote unquote, where it's like a psychopath goes into a bar, sees a clown there. It's like, hey, I used to watch you on TV. You used to be funny. What happened? And then he stabs him to death. And as Arthur is bleeding to death on the ground, this guy takes the knife and cuts open his cheek, just the way that Heath Ledger did in The Dark Knight, and told all those, you want to know how I got these scars stories? So this is the origin of how he got those scars, and then he laughs very distinctly like how Heath Ledger laughed in The Dark Knight. So I'm sure, I haven't seen Todd Phillips give any interviews about this. I'm sure they're coming out in the upcoming week, and he'll be like, it's up to interpretation, whatever people think.
Yeah.
But it's 100% not. The implication is very clear, based both on the timeline and what they show here, that they're like, yep, this is Gotham City before Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and The Dark Knight Rises. Our two movies are a prequel to that. And they're trying, I think the reason that we're talking about this here, and maybe I assume this is the same reason you're bringing it up, is like, it feels like a scared move on the part of the movie rather than letting it stand on its own and be its own duology or whatever they want to do about the Joker, that they have to be like, no, we're connected to one of the most lauded comic book movie trilogies of all time. And same way that the first movie felt like Todd Phillips being like, hey, Martin Scorsese, senpai, recognize me, or whatever the phrase is. Mm-hmm. And then Martin Scorsese was like, nah, I'm never going to watch that movie. I get it. And then they dress up a judge as Martin Scorsese and kill him in this movie. This same thing feels like, hey, Christopher Nolan, senpai, recognize me, particularly at the end with the car bomb exploding and the whole thing. Like, it's very Christopher Nolan inspired. And it's just sad. Like, do your own thing. This movie would be much more successful if they were like, nope, we can stand on our own and have our own ideas. But it implies to me that they just don't have them.
Well, and like, I wonder where, if that was an idea in the script, or if it was, there was other influence to try to make that happen, because it does feel sort of like nihilistically, like, yeah, we got to do this. It feels like so different from what they were trying to do that I don't know why they would ever creatively be like, let's definitely link these up. The only interpretation of it that matches the tone is like, at the end of the day, what they're saying with this movie is like, this Joker, Arthur Fleck, was a monster, but he came to a point at the end. He came clean. There was some core of empathy there where he at least was honest. And then at the end, he's replaced with the next Joker in line that's more extreme, that doesn't have that, that kills to get there, that is more sociopathic. As if to say, like, hey, in our society, like, we don't take care of each other to the point where we're just making more extreme bad versions of bad people. Mm-hmm. And if we don't stop that, we're all going to end up dying on the floor of an insane asylum after being tortured your entire life. And that to me is match is in a way to interpret that as a tonal match as opposed to a cheap franchise move.
Right. That's very generous of you to throw that out there. I don't necessarily think they meant or thought around any of that, but I do like that as a possible interpretation of the thing.
Well, and let me say, just to be positive for a minute on the movie, yeah. Like, I thought that, like, that at least felt like something. You were so beat up mentally and emotionally at that point in the movie that it's hard to find that meaning. Like, it was sort of like looking up and be like, maybe, but like the movie's definitely not giving you that. Mm-hmm. And then the Scorsese thing, like I clocked that as well. And it also felt like Todd Phillips or the movie being like, see, you're right. This is dumb. And that's why you're the judge here. Mm-hmm. That was my interpretation of that. It was sort of like, again, thumbing back and be like, yeah, that stuff's lame back then. Mm-hmm. The Scorsese thing was more of an honorific rather than a knockdown in my mind. But I do think visually there were a lot of great – Joaquin, again, another great performance. There were some moments that did hit emotion in the musical portion. The song when he's in the interview I thought was actually really nice, and it was well shot the way we sort of came in on Arthur singing the what is Bothered, Bewildered? I don't know.
Yeah, the name of the Bewitched, song. Bothered,
Bewitched. Bewildered. Yeah, that was cool. The shot of him just like laughing in the rain was like just a great shot, I thought. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of those throughout. I was like, this is nice, this is cool, but it just like they weren't able to link them together.
Yeah. I mean, on that note, to give some sort of positive things, I actually did like Lady Gaga in this. I don't think they explained her character very much, but having read a bunch of reviews where they talked about she really wasn't in it at all, I did feel like she was present. Excuse me. I feel like
she was president of the movie.
I'm voting for her. I'm writing her in. I do think she was very much the motivator for Arthur throughout the movie. So even when she was off screen, I certainly felt her presence there. Like I said, very annoying about the singing. I understand what they're doing. Same thing with the dancing where they're like, we're just sort of, you know, shaking our arms a little bit because we're regular people and that's how regular people dance. But if we are being generous, I do think the idea of somebody who becomes completely enamored with the idea of a killer, certainly been explored in movies before, but it's an interesting thing to explore, having her be a fangirl of the Joker, but not of Arthur Fleck. But the key moment to me with her character was, I'm forgetting the actual lyric, but the lyric that she keeps saying about, like, we're going to make a mountain out of a molehill or whatever it was from the actual song, where she's in the middle of the interview. She's allowed to go, like, literally anywhere. She shuts down Catherine Keener's lawyer, and the lawyer leaves, and she's like, we're going to make a mountain out of the molehill. There was one reporter in the back that was like, what are you talking about? Yeah. And I don't think that was supposed to be funny, but that was the one point when I laughed in the movie, because I was like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
What is anybody talking about in this movie? That, again, to me, felt like sort of a key scene with that character and maybe the whole film.
Well, and I think I agree. I did like Lady Gaga in this, but like, I just wanted her to like take the shackles off. I wanted the movie to let her cook, like let her sing out, let the character be in love. Like, let's see that love. They mute it so much. The musical numbers and the fantastical nature of them ends up making them feel emptier rather than like huge expressions of love. And I was like, because at the end of one of my bigger takeaways is like, this movie just has a perspective problem. Like, you can't really get on board with Arthur's, you can't be in his shoes because it's so dark. And also he's tortured through the movie. So it's just, we as the viewer, like, I can't get in there. You're not in Lady Gaga's shoes. You're just not watching this movie. You're witnessing it like a car accident as opposed to in the story, which is what I think we want, especially with a romance, especially with a musical. You got to be there with the characters. And I just wanted to get in on it. It only happened a couple of little flash moments. The scene with Arthur's assistant when he's in court, he's representing himself, and I forget it, Mr. Puddles. Mm-hmm. Like, that was really upsetting. And that was where the moment where it sort of that breaks Arthur and sort of fully dispenses with the Joker character. And that was really upsetting, but, and I was there emotionally for it, but when that scene ends, you're left with nothing. you're left with like, God, it's just bad for everyone.
Let's talk about the moment that breaks him from being the Joker, because I don't think it was the Gary Puddle scene. It should have been that let some humanity crack through. But he's still the Joker up until he gets taken back to the prison. And we have this guard played by Brendan Gleeson, who is basically treating him like a pet the entire movie, right? Yeah. Like trading jokes for cigarettes, occasionally like slaps him on the back of the head. Clearly has a little bit of rage issues there. But this was a little unclear to me. Maybe you picked up on something. But I think what drives him over the edge is that Joker calls him fat on television. Is that what it is? And so when he gets back to the prison that night, he's still Joker. He's still in the makeup. Brendan Gleeson makes him wash off the makeup in the bathroom with two other guards. They throw him to the ground. And then it cuts. And we see him being basically like catatonic. He shows up in court the next day and gives the whole speech about, I'm not Joker. I'm just Arthur Fleck, knock, knock, who's there, etc. They're not clear about what's happened, but there's no visible wounds on him or anything like that. I think the implication is trigger warning here, I guess, but they raped him in the bathroom?
I believe so. And I was like, guys, not necessary. What are you doing here?
That's my question is like, if that is what happened and a million other things could happen, maybe they just like gave him a stern talking to, but probably not.
Yeah.
What is the message we're supposed to take away from that? That Arthur was the Joker until he was raped by three prison guards. And then he's like, no, I'm just Arthur Fleck.
Well, and is it, if those guards are meant to represent what society, like structure in our lives, or like the systems that keep us where we are, like what we're just meant to be like, yep, that's how it happens. The things that keep you down will crush you, and that's what needs to happen. That's what the story is. I was like, unnecessary. Like, and I do think when coming on the heels of that scene with Mr. Puddles, that felt like an emotional hit. I was like, why did you then crush that? Because I think if they had just taken that, that could have been the thing that opened him up in a positive way, rather than more abuse is what then is like gets us to this openness or this revelation that he has in court. And I was like, that to me, I was like, what dark take on the world do you have that's the choice you're right? Film and then leave in the cut of the final cut of the film.
I mean, I think this points to kind of what I was getting at before, that the whole trial almost across the board is a misstep, in my opinion. I mean, I'll point to Zazie Beetz showing up as Sophie, his neighbor, which was, I was squirming in my seat, and not because like, ooh, I'm uncomfortable because they're really pushing my buttons so much as Zazie Beetz, great performer. She's great in pretty much everything. Here, it felt like they had her lines on cards and she just kind of showed up. And the whole idea of the character is like, I don't know this guy. I've never met this guy. So it's very much like, please remove me from this movie. Stop involving me in this. Stop talking to me. I have no further information to add here. It's an awful scene that doesn't add anything to the movie and makes her feel like it's viscerally uncomfortable. To jump to the Puddles thing again, there was, again, no other information added there. Like, I think there's emotional information, to your point, that we get through Puddles. But that character is basically like, please, can we move this narrative forward in any way?
Yeah.
But there's nothing that's coming out from Arthur defending himself. I know you said earlier, like, oh, we're getting to the fun part. It's not that this Joker is a fun thing to watch, but there was nothing pushed forward by having Joker defend himself.
Some story,
exactly. We don't, nothing.
And progressed. I think that, like to your point, I think the courtroom actually slows it down because it adds some structure, but there's just nothing. There's not much at stake because we know that there's going to be some eventual Harley Joker confrontation. Like that, we know the trial isn't the end. Like it's just like a little bit of business, and it definitely any momentum the movie had, it really undercuts it there. Well, one other thing I want to talk about is. what is this movie? Was this movie sponsored by like Marlboro? Why is everyone smoking so much?
Oh my God.
It's crazy.
Too much. I was particularly was like, you guys gotta sing. Stop smoking. That's bad.
And I was trying to find meaning in that. And it, is it like cigarettes are, we know they're bad for us, but they're a temporary bit of joy for people that smoke. And that's like all we're given in this life. That's the only takeaway I could have. Cause I was like, the amount of smoking is, it feels like an exclamation point on something. And I don't know what.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the thing that I took away is all the cool people in the movie smoked and the uncool people didn't smoke. So I feel like smoking's cool.
Yeah. I guess it's working. I guess it's working.
Yeah, I agree. There was just so much cigarette smoke in this movie. I think it was just like, yeah, 80s movies, they smoked, right? Is that the sort of thing? I guess we'll do that.
I guess, but I was like, not even movies from the past, even any jokey Mad Men style interpretation of the 60s, they're not smoking that much. When the doctor's shaving him or the guard's shaving him and the cigarette's like in his face, I was like, he would not have that up against his cheek when he's shaving him.
Yeah. That whole thing, I'm glad you pointed out because I had blocked that out after the showing, but then the entire time I was like, stop it, put away the cigarettes. Like you can smoke in a movie, I guess it's fine, but that was over the top. Can we talk about Catherine Keener a little bit? Another actor that I like that I'm just not sure what was going on there. Another character that it felt like the lines were being fed to her right before she went on, where she was like, I don't know what I'm saying right now.
Yeah. Well, I also think she wasn't given much. She was given we don't know anything about her. She's just meant to be there to take care of Arthur a little bit. I feel like she's a mom. She's meant to be like the mom we all have or like the caregiver in our lives that is trying to help us unconditionally. And she is, and she wants him to be better, but she just gets rejected and brushed off like a little dust mote in the air, blown away, and we don't get anything from her, I feel like.
There was a thing that I wanted to like that I don't think worked because they didn't want to play it out comedically. Arthur kissing her constantly.
Yeah.
That was to me that it was like, this is, I think, supposed to be funny, but I'm not sure because of how they were playing it seriously, like in a disturbing way, like, oh, he's kissing me. But in a more darkly comic movie, that is something about like constantly kissing your lawyer is a gross but funny joke that they could have played and they just did not.
Well, and it sort of feels like it's like when the hero kisses the romantic interest right before doing the crazy thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is that what you're doing here? Because it didn't play to me. But I think like Todd Phillips or this movie or his movies, I guess we could say, I think – fair to say, not great at female characters. And that's definitely true in this movie. And it felt like almost purposefully so in the first one. This one, it feels like just doesn't quite nail. And then I also think he's coming out of being like one of the more successful comedy directors. And he seems to be like, I don't do that anymore. Jokes are dumb. And we don't do jokes like that. We do weird stuff that happens. And if you think that's funny, fine. But it's not a joke.
Yeah, we're going to make you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Cool. One other positive that I'll say about the movie, though, great to see Harry Lotti, who played Harvey Dent, in a scene with Ken Leung.
Yes, industry reunion.
Yeah, it was an industry reunion on screen. I really wanted them to start talking about Pierpoint or something. But
honestly, I missed his accent in this movie. And right after that scene, I hear listening to his Harvey Dent accent, I was like, oh, this sounds weird.
if anybody doesn't watch Industry, by the way, there are two actors who are on HBO's Industry. Very fun to see them together. That's the whole point there. But that was fun. Anything else? Obviously, there's a lot of stuff we skipped. I did want to say, jumping back to a point we made earlier, not to rewrite this movie at all, but like per the trial thing where I think it goes wrong, I think what the movie wants to be at the beginning is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest into Natural Born Killers. And that to me would have been at least more interesting to watch and had a clearer arc over the course of the movie. They escape, they go on a rampage. You still have those same beats of him being like, I just want to be Arthur. I just want to start a family. But you have it with a more direct plot versus the second thing that brings everything to a grinding halt.
I agree. Natural Born Killers. The thing that I was thinking of during it is there's an old lauded SNL sketch from like the first season, I want to say, where Steve Martin is sees a girl across the room and then they start dancing. Mm-hmm. And it's this huge, wild dance, and the party is continuing around them, and it's just them being crazy and funny, and then it eventually comes back, and they're just separate across the room, and they never sort of connect. Mm-hmm. And it's a great sketch. It's one of the more artful sketches that they used to do more of back in the day. And it felt like that should have been what this movie is these two people, maybe they only see each other once in that first moment when they see each other. And it's just this flight of fancy for two lonely people who are like have been crushed by society. And we get to see that all play out. And it's a just a little beautiful, not have to make a whole point about the first movie. And it's just a little parable about like, yes, it's hard, but we can find love no matter where we are or no matter what's happened to us or whatever. And I think maybe that's what I was walking into the movie with. So that's my bad to have that expectation. But this movie was literally doing the opposite of that. It's like, you want to have a dream? Crush, boot heel, and smash your dream in front of your face and then smash your face.
Well, I think it's consistent with the tone of the first movie, at least from my perspective, where they came in being like, I am a provocateur. I am going to provoke you. Have you ever dealt with something like this crazy Joker guy who lives in a society? And then the second movie was very much like, oh, did you like the first movie? Well, I'm still a provocateur and I'm going to provoke anybody who likes it and get at you instead of just telling a story and telling a story of two people and having an actual idea and an emotional intent there, which is not what we got. We haven't talked about the most important character who did come back from the first movie and the second movie, which is the stairs. That was pretty exciting to see the Joker stairs. They mentioned halfway through the movie, she was like, I got an apartment near those stairs. And I was like, oh, it's coming. You're teasing
I know. And I was like, what a weird to be like, well, we got to have the stairs. And it comes, stairs come back twice. She's walking up alone and she's like, I'm ascending to Joker. And then it's where they have their final, like, again, unnecessarily sad breakup moment on the stairs. I was like, it just made me laugh.
Yeah, it was all very unnecessary. It would have been much better if he then tumbled down the stairs. That would have been very funny. Any other thoughts on the movie here? Obviously, we jumped around all over the place a little bit. Sounds like we were generally bummed out about it more than outright hated it, I think. Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, it's there's some filmmaking here. There are some ideas at play. It's just these aren't ideas that I think anybody wants. And it feels a little bit of a pushback on us as audience fans, anything. And I think it's especially bleak, a movie, like you were saying about being a provocateur. If you're a provocateur and then a second provocateur, it sounds like you're actually getting conservative the second time. If you're rejecting the rejection, you're going back to the mean or the median there. And that's what I think this movie does a bit, especially with the end, where it just plugs in back into the franchise with setting up the Heath Ledger Joker. And I was like, okay.
Good for you.
Nice. You did the thing that the first movie was very aggressively not doing, I feel
like. Right. And also you did the thing, not to get too much into it, but is directly antithetical with what they were trying to do with the Joker in The Dark Knight, which is he has no origin movie. He is lying. He's telling stories you never know where he comes from. And here they're like, we're going to explain it. Slicey, slicey.
What? And I think it cheapens it. His point, maybe the point is like, yeah, that cool part of the movie is also dumb because no one in the world can be that interesting. They're just ripping off someone else and doing it in a more extreme or worse way. And I was like, oof, you made me like another movie less? That's hard.
The other place, and then I do want to move on and talk about the box office a little bit before we wrap up here, as we promised at the beginning, but in that my mind immediately went to, I don't know how much of Gotham you watched, but on Gotham, they were specifically, for still relatively unknown reasons, not allowed to use the Joker. Like, they were like, no, the Joker's reserved for the big screen. You can't use the Joker on here. So they had to jump backwards to try to figure out a way to include some form of the Joker on Gotham without actually ever calling him the Joker. So they came up with this character called Jerome, played by Cameron Moynihan. Yes. And he was awesome. He was fantastic in the role. Maybe arguably the best Joker of all time, even though he wasn't the Joker. He was utterly fantastic on the show. But they kept having to explain to him, like, no, he's not the Joker. He's not going to become the Joker. He is the proto-Joker. He is the guy who inspires the Joker later on to be the Joker. And that was the same thing here. And I was like, but you didn't have to do that. Nobody was telling you you couldn't do it. So why did you do this thing that they were boxed in on a show for 5 seasons on purpose? That's crazy.
Well, and why are we being so precious about the Joker when there's been like 9 of them? It's like, guys, fine. Just do more of them or don't do more of them. But like, don't have to do half more of them.
It's crazy. All right. Why don't we talk about the box office a little bit? Because I'm curious to get your take on this. So again, we are taping this like right now as I'm looking at the time, about an hour before the official box office receipts or unofficial box office receipts come out. But it was expected initially to make like $80 to $90 million, and then they brought it down to like $60 to $70 million. And as of this recording, it looks like it's going to have an opening weekend of $47 million or probably less, because it seemed to be dropping over the course of the weekend. The Thursday night previews, when I saw it, made $7 million, which is about similar to the Marvel $6.6 million. Now, And it's had a very similar pattern. Like, I don't remember the exact box office for the Marvels, but that was around like mid-40s as well, after the first movie opened huge, went on to make $1 billion. Again, I think in my mind, this points somewhat to the bad word of mouth. It had a D or D minus cinema score, which is what they measure when people come out of the movie, whether they're going to recommend it, which is worse than Megalopolis, the Francis Ford Coppola movie came out that bombed. Yeah, pretty bad. And the worst one for a comic book movie of all time. I still think it is more that 2024 is a different time than 2019. And that's a huge amount of the knock here than anything that has necessarily to do with the movie, even though I like both of these Joker movies exponentially less than, say, Captain Marvel and the Marvels. But what's your take on it, Justin?
I mean, I do think, while this is a very disappointing box office, I bet it will tick up a little bit and maybe have a little bit of legs to it, more than some movies do, like more than like Marvels did. Just because word of mouth is bad, but I think people will still want to see it. It is a spectacle, and I think some of those take longer to get going. But I do also think that this is a testament to, like, you got to pay off your promise, I think, with a lot of movies. Like, the way that Deadpool and Wolverine did, it was like, this movie's going to be huge. It's going to be a big comedy. There's going to be a lot of stuff happening all the time. And that's, you can have your criticisms of that movie, but that's what it did. It did that. Inside Out 2, the number one grossing movie of the year, did that. It was like, this is what you want, and we've given you more of it. So I think it is just like, we're more online and more connected than ever before. So we want to know the thing and then get the thing. And if you deviate from that, it's harder to succeed.
Yeah. What about the whole DCU of it? This is something that I'm not necessarily sure about, but like, none of the DC movies have performed at all pretty much since they announced DC Studios, though also timed out for the bubble popping around comic book movies in general. So do you think this at all, in two directions, to ask two questions kind of simultaneously, you've got one school of thought of like, oh, people didn't see The Flash and they didn't see Aquaman 2 because they've already announced the new DCU. So people are like, it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. That's not setting anything up. We're just going to wait for James Gunn's Superman on. That's one process of thought. The other process of thought, the thing that's been setting off my alarm blouses a little bit, is like, maybe people don't want to see DC movies in general. Like, maybe this actually is a little bit of a canary in a coal mine for the new CDCU, for Superman, Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow, etc. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I feel like Joker deviates from that because of the previous success, and it definitely doesn't feel like a DC movie. You know, there's no Batman, there's no complicated storyline. I would chalk this up more to people are like, wait, it's a musical? Like, wait, what? And then the bad take on it, the bad word of mouth, is sort of just confirming like, oh, this isn't for me. It's not. I'll just rewatch the first one because that's what I love. And I bet there's amongst fans, maybe there's more of like anticipating James Gunn, but I think the general audience is like, what, when's that coming? Like, oh, a Superman movie. And then they'll get involved in that hype and that will be much more positive, fun, bright, new tone to DC. I also think it could be that they're sick of this tone of like, you know, dramatic darkness. When what they want, and I think everyone's sick of the Marvel tone of just like snarky Robert Downey Jr., Tony Stark, snark, as it were.
Stark.
Everyone wants sort of a new tone that is, it feels fresh, and it could be just going in a new direction. But this is not new, I don't think.
I think that's fair. I mean, I still have my worries, as I just expressed, but I do think this comes down to, whoever liked Joker was like, yes, great one and done movie. So nobody was really asking for a sequel to that. Certainly those people don't want to see musicals a lot of the time. So it was a thumbing the nose in terms of expectations. So yeah, we'll see how it does long term. We'll see if it does have more legs, as you're saying. In the meantime, if you'd like to support this podcast and all the podcasts, we do patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. to Facebook and YouTube. Come hang out. We would love to chat with you about the DCU. Apple, Spotify, Android, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow the show at Comic Book Live on Twitter /X Comic Book Club Live. .com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, Dad, looking forward to your movies instead.
And please stop me from smoking. I love smoking now, Dad.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.